All right, good morning. Welcome to the last day of the conference, finally. Whereas yesterday we spent a lot of time looking at things from a whole game perspective, like here's all the issues you have to deal with a team and planning and all sorts of things like that, today we're going to look more at different components of development process. So things like if you set out to write some reusable code, you know, for a specific library, how should you do that? Or if you want to take a specific task, like integrating physics with your game, what do you need to think about? Once again, I'd like to remind everybody we've passed out evaluation forms, and we'd appreciate it if you fill them out and hand them back into us by the end of the day. Let us know how we're doing. Let me introduce Casey Muratori, who's going to talk about designing and evaluating reusable components.
Okay, so code reuse is something that, in general, everyone wants to be able to do. Either in-house or externally, you typically want to be able to solve a problem once or license, you know, a solution from somebody and just integrate it into your game and have it work. It's kind of a goal that's common across many industries, not just the game industry. And so it's no surprise that there's lots of books on it, there's lots of people who speak on the topic, this sort of thing. But in general, what seems to typically be the case is that a lot of the things that you hear about this or think you know about this when you actually try to put them into practice, it turns out that it doesn't really work that well. And you kind of sit there scratching your head going like, you know, we thought that we were doing some of this code reuse stuff well, or we thought this component that we looked at to license had a good API, but when we actually try to use it in our game, we kind of like start to feel like getting a little more NIH about the problem because, God, it just didn't work out that well. It caused all sorts of problems and so on. So where this lecture kind of comes from is I worked at Rad Game Tools, and I was responsible for doing Granny, which is the character animation package. And at the outset of that, I kind of made the first version of it according to what I thought were standard, you know, reusable code principles. And it turned out to just not really work very well. You know, a lot of people had a lot of trouble integrating it. Things just didn't go the way that I thought they should. So we spent a lot of time when we went from 1.0 to 2.0 kind of looking at that and going, you know, what happened there? And we learned a lot of things, and the second incarnation of the product actually is used in, I think, 400 different SKUs, which is a vast, vast increase from the original one. So with this lecture, I kind of tried to go back and go, okay, what were all the things we learned about that? And how do we make that jump? Are they generally applicable? And are there like things that we can kind of generalize from this that are real rules we can use to get reuse in the game industry that are from practice and not just some kind of theoretical thing that doesn't seem to really play out in practice? So before I get into it, I just wanted to quickly go over the types of reuse that we typically see. The first kind here on the left is what I call layer, which is sort of like an OpenGL or Direct3D kind of a thing, where you've got new code that you're writing on top, which is your game or something. You've got reused code, which is the layer, which is the you know, Direct3D part or whatever the API is that's provided, to abstract some service that's down at the bottom, which is like the 3D hardware or something like this. And this kind of reuse is pretty common now, and it seems to be working relatively well. There's still problems with it and that sort of thing. The second kind is engine code, which is kind of inverted. It's like the reused code is up at the top, making all the decisions, just the majority of the system, and you're just writing kind of this smaller subset of that, conforming to its rules, giving it information back to define your game. And it's pretty much responsible for ending up dealing with all the output and that sort of thing. And then finally, we have the third kind, which is kind of the new thing, which hadn't been around really in any successful way up until very recently, which is components. And those are things where it's still kind of like the layer situation, where the new code is up at the top. You know, the game code is all in control. But there's kind of these little pieces that you can license, which not only accept input from you, but actually give stuff back to you that actually determines how the game runs. They're tightly integrated. And these are things like character animation, physics, AI, that sort of thing. And they don't really talk to services directly. There's no well-defined output layer for them. They just give you stuff back, and then you're responsible for kind of doing it. Now, the reason those are important, and the reason that layers aren't the only thing that we need, I mean, engines I'm not really going to cover because that's just, you know, a totally separate topic. The reason that components are important is because if you look at layers, they're very limited. They require there to be some well-defined kind of service at the bottom that they're abstracting, like 3D hardware. And if they don't have something like that, so if you want to do something like AI where there's no agreed-upon standard for what the output is, then they just, you know, they can't really exist. And similarly, if you have, you know, two layers that you're trying to use in the game simultaneously, well, that just isn't going to work at all. You know, if I have two things that expect to be talking to the 3D hardware, that can be a huge disaster because each one wants control over it, and how do you broker between them? So it's no longer this clean, like, I give something to it, it puts something out. Now, components solve both of these problems. They don't need a service at the bottom. They can just be there. They get, you know, you give them data, they process it, they give it data back, it's all good. And similarly, if there's one service, you know, one output that you're dealing with that both services are that both components are concerned with, that's fine because the input is coming back into the game where you can broker between it, resolve conflicts, do anything you need. So components are really like the most powerful form of subsystem reuse that there is, and they're the ones that we happen to need to solve a lot of the problems of reuse that we, you know, for components we don't have currently. The problem with them is they're much harder to design. And the reason for that is this little back channel here that I drew. I mean, it's like a little simple arrow, but in reality, like the fact that it is coupled back to the game and you have to rely on what it's giving you to make gameplay decisions, to do all these things, really does mean that it's a vastly harder design problem than just output only. And not to say that, you know, Direct3D and OpenGL weren't hard to design, it's just these are even harder, and that's unfortunate. So, what I'm going to do here is, for a couple slides, I'm going to introduce kind of like a model for how to look at the way games integrate things, which may or may not be unique to how other industries integrate things. I don't have much experience with that. But for games, there's a very specific way that integration typically happens with components. So I'm going to go through a little bit of that, and then I'm going to go into some really very in-depth code snippet kind of stuff where I take you through all of the different ways that kind of you can use this model to look at what's happening and making decisions about either is some licensable API that I'm going to use going to work well, or I'm trying to design an API that I can reuse in-house or for other developers, you know, what can I do to make those APIs better? So here's my little sort of pseudo graph. The vertical axis here is how much work was done to integrate the particular API into our game. And down here is time. And what some people like tend to gloss over if you read books about this sort of thing is that integration isn't really something that you just sit down and do. We don't like one day decide to integrate physics into our game, we spend a week on it, and then we're done. And that's the last we hear of it. That's not what happens. What really happens is, yes, that part of the process is over here somewhere. We do the initial integration and it's in the game. But then in reality, we get usually, as we go, we use a little bit more of it, and then we get to some point where we have some major push that we're trying to do. And at that point, we typically have to start getting more involved with that API because there's things we need to do. Like, for example, we have memory budgets we need to hit. We need to add some features that we didn't think we were going to have to need or that we put off integrating, and now we need them for this demo. We need them for whatever we're trying to ship. And we get kind of this little spike there. And similarly, that typically happens again at least once at the end of the project when we're trying to ship. There's all of these hard constraints that we have to meet. So it really is an evolving usage. It goes from initial, where we might even just be prototyping a game, so we're not even doing the official integration, all the way till like we're trying to ship and nail down every little last piece. Okay, so here's the kind of like abstract part. So try to put on your abstract cap. What I want to do is get you in the mindset of thinking about the options that you or other developers have for integrating a particular thing into their game, a particular component. Now, I took time out of this now, so we're just looking at a single point in time, and the amount of work to integrate something is here, and the amount of benefit to the game is here, and these little big blue circles are just representing options that the developer has for integration. So, you know, when I go to integrate something like character animation into my game, there's a number of ways I could do it. I look at the game engine, I look at the component, and I go, well, we could do something like this, we could wrap it like this, we could put it in over here, we could fork it and put it part of it over here and over here. So you've got a number of ways in which you could integrate it. And typically, as you go, you know, the more integration work it is for you, typically the more benefit you could get, because the more tighter coupled you become to this component, the more things you can do with it. You know, if you start managing its memory for it, then you're going to get performance benefits, and there's all these kind of things that as you go up. So what happens is, when you initially integrate it in, you've got some minimum bar that you're trying to meet in terms of benefit. You've got, like, we need these features for the game right now, so we're just going to try and meet that. And, you know, hey, you have particularly smart programmers, so they're going to kind of go, well, this is kind of the thing that's the least amount of work that gives me the most amount of benefit that meets the bar, right? But, you know, I could do a little more work and maybe get something that I thought was a little more beneficial, so maybe I will. You know, so there's kind of, you're going to pick something kind of down here to get it in, get it working, get the game running, and get on with things. Then as you go, at some point, there's going to be some new requirements. You're going to need more benefits from this API. And when I say benefits, I don't necessarily mean features. I just mean there are things that you need from it. The ability to, like, get its memory footprint down, the ability to, like, reclaim some processor time. Those things are all considered part of this because, you know, again, they're integral to shipping the game. So as this bar moves across, well, you're kind of going to start going, okay, well, we need to kind of integrate a little more, we need to integrate a little more, and you change what we're doing, call some different APIs, do that sort of thing. And you move through this kind of space of possibilities that you had. And then finally, what happens if you get into trouble is you get to some part where the requirements change and there is no easy jump to get you there, right? You have this thing that you have to do, and maybe it's like some kind of hard budget that you have to meet, and you realize that the way that you were using the API, there just is no simple fix. There's no way that you can get, say, streaming, which you want to implement in your game, into this component in any reasonable amount of work. It's going to be this massive thing where you have to do all sorts of stuff behind its back and do all these kind of things. So you end up looking at a situation like this where you're like, wow, to get this extra thing that we needed to do to ship this game, we have to do a massive amount of work to deal with this component. So to kind of summarize that, it's like, hey, if the API has these little steps, and I want to meet this minimum bar of features that I've got to get for this next drop, I want to go from unsolved to solved. I just want to take a little step. I want to do some work to get it, whatever I feel is the minimum amount of work that I should generally have to do to get this thing in there. But if there is no options for that, then they typically will have to jump all the way to something which, while you had to do a ton of work to get there, it really, you know, solved a lot more problems than you were looking to solve. You ended up doing a lot more management or a lot more work with this component than you would have liked, and maybe there are fringe benefits to that, but a lot of times those benefits aren't really realized to you. You just wanted to manage one little piece of it for the component, for example, but now you ended up having to manage all of its memory, let's say. So I call that an integration discontinuity, which is like I'm kind of going along using this component, and all of a sudden I hit this wall, and I'm like, man, this is a disaster. And unfortunately, they typically happen around ship time, just when it's like most unfortunate to have such a thing happen. So I guess this is kind of a little like beating a dead horse, but just to go through it. If you think about this yellow line as how much work you actually did to integrate the product, meaning I'm actually doing this work and I keep doing work and I do more work and I do more work. When you have these discontinuities in there, what happens is you're really doing more work than the benefit that you were getting, right? So when I have to do more work than the minimum that I wanted to do to get this feature in, then the actual benefit to your app isn't going up commensurate with the work. You're like spending a lot of extra work to work around this API that you're forced to deal with. And this doesn't even have to be increasing, because what could happen is if you're spending time integrating the component, you may find out that the way that you are integrating it isn't actually working, and you have to like rip some of it out, redo the way you were doing it, throw out code you wrote to reintegrate it a different way. So you can actually end up going like, okay, we got to tear some out. We tried this other method, and that didn't work, so then we tried going around it this other way, and we finally found an end run that worked, and now we keep going and so on. So I guess all I'm trying to say with this graph is like it's non-trivial. When you have these like API problems in there, it really can force you to blow out a lot of work. And that's why I posit that's like the real problem. The goal that we're trying to solve when we dissolve reusable APIs is to think about this and to try to make it so that at all times as people integrate the product, they're always able to do only what they think they should have to do to get the next thing that they need out of the API and not waste all of this time. Because really, when they use code, I mean, from a licensing perspective, that's what the customer ends up remembering, right? They don't remember if you saved them some work at some point. They remember when you caused them this huge disaster right around ship time, right? And similarly, if you're the person doing that, you don't want that disaster. So this is really the thing that I think is most important. Now, unfortunately, the current trends in API design a lot, you know, with things where you're kind of wrapping stuff up, doing a lot of encapsulation, doing a lot of insulation, what they actually do is they take the number of options that are available to the developer, which are these, you know, blue things like I said before, and they start to reduce them. They go, you know what, you can't really have access to these things. You can't call these things without calling these other things. And at some point, sometimes you even get to the point where you look at an API and you're like, you know what, there's only one thing I can do with this. Like, they've totally walled me off. I have no options anymore. This is a disaster. And these kind of components typically fail. But a lot of times we're stuck with just this kind of thing where, like, kind of there's a low level or a high level way to use it and so on. And I argue that really, like, you know, we want things to look like this and ideally fill in this gap that I was talking about before. Okay, so that's kind of the end of the abstract part. So now you're going to have to read some code snippets on here. So hopefully, can everyone like read this well enough to see, say, that? Yes. Second me? Okay, good. So these are the characteristics that I have identified that I think are sort of indicative of how that those blue points are, because that was very abstract. You know, I drew a graph, had some blue points on it. You know, well, that's all great, but how do I actually know when I'm looking at an API, you know, is it going to have these problems? Are there discontinuities in there? You know, how much options does it really give me? And originally, I only had four. In fact, if you look in my lecture notes, there were only four. But I was showing some of the slides to Chris Hecker, and he was like, you don't talk about flow control enough. You got to talk about flow control. It's implicit in all the things you're talking about, but you're not talking about. So I looked at it, and he was totally right. So I added a fifth one, which kind of like does really it does really matter. So props to Chris for that. The five things are, in order, granularity, which is to say that, you know, I have some API and I can split it into smaller APIs. So if I have an API A, I can replace it with two APIs that do the things that it did but give me a little more control. There's redundancy, which is to say that there's an API that does something, which is A, but I could alternatively call some other API which does the same thing, B, only maybe it takes slightly different parameters or it does it in a slightly different way. So I have, you know, some options there. There's coupling, which is when you have one thing, and if you do that thing in the API, you're required to do some other thing. So there's like this hidden kind of link in between them that you are not really able to overcome. There's retention, which is when the API kind of has two things, and like one's on your side, and then the other's on their side, and you have to kind of mirror them, like making a scene graph or something like this. And finally, there's flow control, which is like, who's calling who? Am I calling them? Is the component calling me? Am I calling it, and it's calling me back? You know, what's going on here? Now, the important thing to remember is these are just characteristics, and each one of them has trade-offs, which I'll talk about later. So it's not, some of them are always bad, but the majority of them have, like, sometimes it's good to have like, less granularity, sometimes it's good to have more. So, you know, don't think of them as, like, hard-coded. We want all these five things. It's like, no, they're, each one of them is just a characteristic, and we'll talk about how to interpret them in a second. So to go through the kinds of granularity, because some of them are non-obvious. The most obvious thing is, hey, if I have something like update orientation, and what this function is supposed to do is the API has some measure of my orientation that it's keeping, and it's got some measure of the change in orientation, and I want to go ahead and apply that change, so now when I use the orientation, it's the new orientation. Well, you know, simple granularity change is, okay, I want to break that down into steps. I want to get the orientation myself, I want to get the change in orientation myself from the API, and then I want to, you know, set the thing with that change. And these are angles or something, so that's not like any kind of overloaded plus operator. It's just like, you know, hey, it's like, you know, just a regular 2D angle. That's the most simplest kind of granularity. The reason that I want that is because, hey, I may want to modify whatever is going to happen in there, right? I may not want it to just use it directly, the change that it has. I may want to play with it, right? And similarly, the kind of less obvious version of that is, I may not ever want to change it. I may want this to happen exactly the same way that it would have if I just called it, but I have this other thing that I want to have happen. So instead of like modifying things by inserting myself in the middle, really all I'm doing is I'm separating when the API is going to do those two things. And that may not be that important in other industries, but in the game industry, that's like crucial because sometimes you thread things, sometimes you have like kind of things that you need to hold over till the end of the frame. So you really don't want to be in positions where you don't have that kind of control. So that kind of granularity is also important. So
what if doing that get causes a lock on another thread then?
Well, so, I mean, again, it's the developer's choice. right? If your attitude is always, let me protect the developer from anything that could possibly happen to them, well, you know what? I had a diagram of that. That was this, right? And, you know, a lot of developers who are integrating things are really smart. They understand all these things. And what they need is the control to be able to do their job, not you to protect them from any little thing that might happen. Now, again, I'm going to talk about that in a second, how, like, protection is good. You don't really want to ship an API that's going to allow the developer to shoot them in the foot every 10 seconds. But the idea is you don't want to presuppose that your only job as API developer is to prevent the integrator from making a mistake. Because if that's your only job, then you end up with what I talked about, which is really the cause of a lot of our problems. Okay, so now let's talk about redundancy. Because granularity, hopefully that's pretty clear. So redundancy is just, you know, in its most basic form is something like this. I wanted to pass a 3x3 matrix before, and now I want to pass a quaternion. So the API gives me two calls, and I can enter in either way, and it just accepts the, you know, the type of parameter that I was looking for. Doesn't do anything different. C and D are a different way of looking at that, which is that, hey, sometimes I figure that there should be, like, these basic things that it can just do for me. I don't want to have to make my own identity matrix and pass or that sort of stuff. There's just constants that the API builds in that's easy for me to use, and that way, you know, I just know it's taken care of. And similarly, oftentimes there are things that I would do with the orientation, and I just want it to do those basic operations for me to set the operation, I mean, to set the orientation, rather, and that's D. So those are just some different redundant ways of doing that. Now, the sort of subtle way of having redundancy is this kind here, where if you remember in the previous slide, I couldn't fit on this slide, we had this kind of operation where we're getting the orientation, getting the change in the orientation, and then setting it. Well, if I was to go up a level of granularity from that, I could have the option of bundling those three calls in two different ways. I could bundle the first two calls and leave the third one at the low level, I mean the finer level of granularity. Or I could bundle the second two calls and leave this one at the finer level. So they're both like kind of equivalent. They're at the same level of granularity, these two snippets, but they have different choices in redundancy in terms of they have different choices in what to bundle, which makes kind of a redundant API there. So that can typically be pretty useful as you make coarser grained versions of an API to have the user have the ability to choose which ones they're going to bundle, which ones they're not. So now we get to coupling, which is not really a trade-off thing. Coupling is pretty much always bad. But, you know, it's usually also unavoidable in a lot of places. So the simplest kind of coupling in an API is when you have something that does, like, a bunch of things to lots of objects, and you have no control over that. So, you know, a very typical thing is, like, simulate in a physics simulator, where it's just like, hey, you know, maybe I wanted some control over what was getting simulated because I have some special things that I want here. But, like, maybe this API doesn't let me do that, so I have to just, like, have everything happen at once. Okay, so obviously that's bad coupling. That's, you know, inter-object coupling. The other kind of coupling is, hey, I've got some APIs which kind of depend on this one state that I set. So maybe I call set time and it retains this time information, but then like lots of different APIs use that. So I'm kind of creating a hidden sort of coupling between those APIs in the sense that, like, you know, now they all have to kind of have this right ordering of if I set the time and then call this, I can't then call the other thing which counted on the time being the thing from the previous frame. So I'm like kind of having this kind of like a hidden coupling that I have to think about in my head. The snippet C is the kind of coupling where you have in like a GL begin, GL end, for example, which is that there isn't any identification for a particular lock that I'm doing, so I can only have one of them at any given time. You know, I don't really get anything back from this, and I don't pass anything into this, so there's really just this one implicit lock that either I am or I'm not using, and that kind of couples it in the sense that two pieces of code can't do that, so you have to make sure that all of the code always just is serially doing something like this. D is very simple, which is, hey, if there are internal buffers, are those internal buffers going to be like things that we have to pay attention to? So in this case, if I was returning a char star, for example, this is probably returning the same buffer as this. So I've got this kind of hidden coupling of like string 1 actually becomes the same thing as string 2 here because, you know, whatever. Hopefully that doesn't happen too much in modern APIs, but, you know, figured I'd mention it. Snippet E is kind of a more insidious form of coupling. It's when the allocation of something is coupled to its initialization. And a lot of APIs have this problem, unfortunately. A lot of times, developers don't really want to have to be able to say, oh, you know what? Get me the memory for this thing and initialize it. They might want to go like, I'm going to provide the memory, and then could you just initialize it in place? Or, you know what? You're managing the memory, but I need to initialize this guy because I'm like reading it from this special stream that I have packed or whatever. So that's a kind of coupling where, like, I bundle two things together that cannot ever be separated. F is where I have coupling between some special type in the system. Like, if I only accept a matrix for my orientation, this is kind of gets back to the redundancy thing. If that's the only type that I accept here, then even if I have some, like, representation of the matrix myself, I have to constantly, like, make it with the other, you know, with the API. I have to say, like, hey, make one of your special fancy matrix objects so that I can actually call your functions. And then the final kind of coupling is when you depend on, when the API doesn't let you get away from depending on their file format. So in this case, it's like, if the only way to get an object is to read that object with their file reading routine, right? I can't construct it myself with my own reading it in, then I'm kind of dependent on their file IO routines and their data format, and there's nothing I can do about that, really. Okay. Retention is pretty simple, so not many code snippets here. The idea there is just, hey, if I have stuff that is, you know, data that I kind of own or that I am the one who's, like, in charge of, but the API forces me to announce that data to it and it keeps a copy, that's retention. So in A, it's the simplest kind. I have, you know, I'm going to set the time or I'm going to set what I think the value of pi should be for the application. Then it just retains that information. It's going to use it everywhere. In B, we have kind of like, yeah, well, you know what? I'm going to tell you that this object is parented to this other object, so every time you do something, like update the orientation, you're going to take that into consideration. And then finally, in D, we have the kind where you're retaining services from the application. So the API is kind of going, you know what? When I open a file, I could call you back with some of these things. So it's going to retain the services that you provided and use them whenever it would have used them in the middle of processing some of its various function calls. And finally, we have flow control. And flow control is pretty easy to imagine. Pretend these are just stack traces. And flow control is just, you know, a measure of flow control anyways. It's like, who is calling who? Is it the case that I, you know, the game is on the bottom of the stack, then it calls into the library, and that's always the way it looks? That's all we get. So library on top, game on bottom. Or do we have a situation where, hey, the game, which, you know, was originally calling the library, now gets called back? And there is sort of library in between game on either side of the stack. Then we could get, you know, totally crazy and say, well, a lot of times then the game has to call the library something for, so we can keep ad infinitum if we allow this kind of flow control stuff to happen. We can get these ridiculous stacks where it's like, I call the library, library calls me back, I call the library, maybe it calls me back one more time. Now, this is obviously, you know, kind of a negative thing, because the more this happens, the more kind of complex it is to visualize in your head what's going on, your relationship to this library. And furthermore, it can be really kind of nasty where it has to call back one of your classes, or you have to have void stars which tell it what the, you know, the data is that you're going to need inside there because you no longer have your scope. So, you know, there's a lot of complexity when you start introducing complicated kinds of flow control that aren't just A. And the files and the code snippets for that are, this is the most basic kind, like we said before. I just call a function and it returns something. Everyone's happy. B is the slightly more complicated version where it's going to call me back. So, you know, I do open file and I get a callback for it. C is just up here because it's the same as B. If anyone thinks that C is not the same as B, definitely rethink that, because, hey, this is just a function pointer, right? A virtual function is just, there's a V table somewhere. So if you're inheriting from one of the API's classes, that's exactly the same thing as setting some file callbacks. And then finally, we have, you know, hey, you could use exceptions or something like this, transfer flow control, but hopefully that's not like a big part of any licensable API. So here's the recap. We have granularity, and essentially what we do with that is we trade off flexibility for simplicity. The more coarser grained the granularity is, the simpler the API is to use, because there's less calls, less things for the user to get wrong, et cetera, et cetera. But we give up flexibility. As we go up there, we're kind of at the point where they're really kind of out of control. You know, they don't have the control, they're kind of just telling you what to do, and the API does it, you know, entirely the way that they want. With redundancy, it's really a trade-off of convenience versus orthogonality. If your thing is very redundant, then you're going to be very convenient because there's tons of these APIs to choose from for every different thing to do, but you're not very orthogonal, right? It's kind of a little harder for the user to keep in their head because there isn't just one way of doing the thing that they're going to do. There's lots of different ways. With coupling, there really isn't much of a trade-off. It's like the API, we'd like it to be as decoupled as possible because all it's doing is putting restrictions on what the programmer can and can't do, so there's really no benefit to that one. Retention is kind of a synchronization versus automation thing where it's like, if I retain a lot of data, then it's kind of hard because the user has to synchronize all that stuff, and that's bad. So you know, immediate mode things are better because there isn't that synchronization involved where they have to constantly keep you updated. But you know, you may lose some automation there because if you have all this retained data, then the API can maybe automate things for you that it couldn't otherwise. And finally, flow control, again, not much of a trade-off there. If you can get away with just always having the game in control and it calls the app and it returns to you, well, that's always simpler because you don't want to have to worry about these like kind of deep callback situations or how you get data down through the library to you on the other side and so on. And the final thing that I want to mention about that is just that looking at all of those trade-offs, they're not necessarily constant throughout the course of the integration. When I first integrate a component into my game, I'm probably looking for very low granularity, so I'm looking for a very coarse-grained granularity approach, and a lot of retention. Because I just want to do something like say, hey, load some characters off disk and animate them walking around and like free them later. Like that's kind of the level I'm looking for when I'm just like pre-production or you know doing my first integration into the game, whatever. But as I get to the end of the project, I typically need the reverse, right? I need a lot of control, so I want fine granularity in several places that I really need to manhandle. And I don't want a lot of retention because I've built all these data structures that say the way my game works, and the less of that I have to mirror on your side, on the API side, the better. So is everyone clear on that? Are there any questions? Okay. So what I'm going to go through now is I'm going to go through some looking at actual code snippets that, you know, they're not exactly the same as code snippets in a game, but they're very, very similar to it. So we can look at what happens when some of these things are not at the proper level that they should be, just to give you a feel for, if you're designing API, how you should be looking at it, or if you're evaluating an API, looking at what the consequences of that API are to your... John? Yeah, sure. No, I mean, and that's, but I don't think that, I don't think I am kind of imagining it as static.
But does that change the scenario at all when the API is changing and all of a sudden you get a new drop and you've got a whole bunch of new integration problems that crop up? I mean, on your graph, you know, I was kind of beta tester 1.0.
Yeah. Well, sure. I mean, if you're beta testing something, then obviously that's going to happen. But even if it's not, like these kind of things are even more important in that scenario, right? Because as an API developer, when you're looking at something like that, the objective is to minimize the amount of that you're going to have to do, right? I mean, and that's like a thing with Granny 1.0, especially. A lot of the things learned there were like, the more we wall this stuff off, then the more that is going to happen. You know, the more that we're going to have to release major changes because people go, oh, you know what, we need access to all this stuff. So all of a sudden, this massive set of APIs has to open up. And oftentimes, when they do, you can't keep the previous APIs the same because they're going to be modified slightly. So I really don't think any of this is invalidated in any way by that. If anything, it's like boosted. In other words, like this, that's just more reason why you should try to look at these things because they're really the things that will prevent that from happening. And you know, obviously, all game development APIs are going to be fluid like that, right? And you know, for as another example, if you look at Granny 2.0 versus 1.0, we've never had that. There's never really been a release of 2.0 which invalidated the way it was integrated. Whereas with 1.0 to 2.0, that was totally the case. Like we had to basically invalidate everything because it was just, you know, most of the thing was just not designed with kind of like the kind of principles that I'm talking about. If that makes sense. But we can talk about that, you know, more in the break. So obviously I've changed this. So this isn't, none of these are specifically somebody's API. They're just like very representative of the standard ones that are out there. So first thing, let's look at game provided services. So in this case, I kind of alluded to this in earlier slides. Here's a case where I want the the API. I was just kind of calling this read file thing in the API, and I was getting back whatever the thing is that it gives me back, some kind of object that I'm going to use. I want to stop it from touching the disk. You know, I'm going to manage that because I'm reading from my own database format or something like that. So typically what most APIs do, assuming they provide this at all, which hopefully they do, is we get something like snippet B, which is that I set some file callbacks, which is basically just me saying I'm providing like fopen, fread, and so on now. So just call me when you would have called those. And the problem with that, not only is it a problem for flow control, because hey, now I'm getting called back by the API, but it's also a problem for coupling in kind of a non-obvious way. And the reason that there's coupling here is because you've bundled the concept of reading the file with interpreting it into this object that you can use. So I've actually kind of smacked two separate things together, one of which is loading an loading an actual like chunk of data off the disk, and the other is interpreting it. So even if I allow the user to do those operations, I haven't given them any control over when they happen, because they're still going to happen right at this call, and there's no way to separate those two things out. So, and you know, if the user wanted to actually separate them out, what they have to do is make heinously complicated versions of these that do like caching behind somebody's back, or you know, God knows what's going to happen. So the much more decoupled way, in which most, like very, very few APIs do, but some do, is to kind of give you the ability to just pass in some file data. It's like, okay, I already read it. Why don't you to go ahead and interpret this into a thing for me, right? And that's kind of more what you want to see, because if you want this kind of control, typically you want something that's a lot more like this, where I'm just feeding it chunks, and it's interpreting them into the type that I want. Now, is that the most decoupled we can get? You know, it's not. You look at that, and you go, well, this is still something that's kind of owned by them, right? The thing that's coming back, like, came back from the API, and I had no control. Like, that's got to have some memory somewhere. Like, something's going on here. At the very least, let's pretend that that file data that it's interpreting is compressed in some way. So at the very least, it's got to decompress it first before it can be used. So what's happening inside this call is we, you know, the API is allocating a buffer, decompressing into it, and then returning me a pointer to some part of that. Well, I could decouple it further, right? I can go like this, which is to say that I want it to decompress this raw file data for me into file data, and then it can you know, make the thing for me that I can use, and then I can get rid of this file data because I don't need it anymore. But the problem with that is, hey, you know what? It's still allocating memory. So then I typically get right back to where I was before, where I have to then give it yet more callbacks. I was trying to eliminate those before, but now I'm right back to it because I got to let it allocate the memory for me. So finally, we get to F, which is more of the like properly decoupled version, which is to say that here, now I've got a four-line version of what was a one-line thing before, but now I have complete control, right? I get the size that I will need for this thing. I malloc that, or NuIt, or however you want to get it, call your own special allocator, do whatever you want. Then I decompress it, and then I ask it to make the thing. So now everything is entirely within my purview here, and all it's doing is translating a pointer to something else. Now, we can still get decoupled one further step. This one is not necessary all the time, but for certain types of APIs, it's crucial. And that is, this is the snippet that we had. But what we really might want to do is something more like this, where we're saying, you know what? I don't really even want you to require me to call one of your functions before I can use some of this data. I don't want your, however your packed data format works to influence that. So what I want to do here is I want to just say, hey, you know what? Give me, make one of these things and I'm going to read it in however the hell I want to read it in, And that's kind of important because maybe I then want to go ahead and control exactly where that thing is placed with my own allocators and read it directly in. And when by the time we get to H, we realize, you know what? We didn't need the API at all for this process, right? Simple two-line thing. If the data is transparent to us, we can just do this and have complete control just like it was something in our game. And we haven't really affected the way the API functions at all, right? All the rest of the API can still work exactly the same way, but now we've kind of removed it entirely from this process. So again, I'm not trying to suggest that the difference between A and H is like always use H or anything like this. I'm just saying like here is an example of the huge spread of ways in which we could do this one thing. And typically, you do end up wanting to do this one quite a bit in an average game for APIs that are tightly integrated. So A is good, and a lot of times the user will call that, but H is also good. And you don't want to be in a situation where the only thing you have is A. So let's look at another common thing, which is parameter redundancy. Parameter redundancy, like I said before, is the ability to kind of like call something with two different flavors or multiple flavors and so on. In A, I have the original version of the API's function, which inverts some transform. And let's pretend that the transform we're passing and the inverse we get back are both in their, like, that's their data type. That's their object or whatever it is. Well, the problem is when we start realizing that, hey, we have our own transform type and we got to kind of pass that in, we end up with something like B, where like maybe I have like a floating point vector of position and a floating point vector that's the rotation, and now I've got to call the API to bundle it up into one of their things, and then when I'm done with their function, I got to call copy transform to kind of, you know, get it out again to, into my format, and that can get really heinous if my version, the object type that I'm using for a transform also has this process that has to happen, then I've got to get it out of mine, put it into theirs, call their function, get it out of theirs, then put it back into mine. And like that seems kind of silly because like all we were doing is this and now we have to do all this. So like, you know, it seems like kind of a contrived example. But at the same time, like I see this all the time in actual code. Like this sort of thing happens all the time. It's not like this kind of random thing. So it's like you're always currying back and forth between these types and it ends up just being this kind of mess. So really what you want to do is get as close as possible to D, which is where maybe the API has several versions of this function because it knows that everyone has their own format for position and orientation. So let's try to provide as many of them as we can to reduce the chances that they have to do this kind of ridiculous dance. So here we're kind of like saying, well, you know, if you've got a quaternion, well, you know, pass that directly into us and we'll just kind of like take these two, modify them, and pass them back out to you. Okay. So let's look at the transition between a coarse-grained operation and a fine-grained one. In code snippet A, I've got kind of a retain mode thing going on here where the app has some kind of object called a node which has some stuff in it, and I'm asking it to update it, and then I'm asking it to render it. Two operations on the node. I've highlighted this one because maybe all I really want to do is change the way that operation works. The rendering is great, all the rendering is happy, but the updating is not doing it things the way I want. So in code snippet B, I've expanded it out. And since I'm not using the node structure anymore, as a developer, I now have to duplicate all of the stuff that that thing did. And I'm just kind of making up some stuff that it did here. The update part did those three things, and the render part did those five things. As you can see, as a developer, I'm a little sad because I didn't really want to know all that render stuff. I didn't want to do any of that, but I had to do it all because I wanted to stop using that node thing so I could get control over the update part. Well, that's not very preferable, and if we look at that, what we really wanted to do is just kind of have the exact same call that was there before, but now instead of using the bundled node type, I just pass the parts of that node type that I wanted. And this is a very easy thing for an API to do, but unfortunately, almost none of them actually seem to do it. A lot of times when they have these kind of bundled constructs, they don't actually provide the exact same function in an unbundled way, which is really kind of unfortunate. And similarly, I could look at a further kind of granularity option, which is if they did want a little bit of control over one of the processes, maybe I even offer another level of granularity in between those two, where it's like, not only do I allow you to kind of go from node to non-node so I can break up these two things and not have to worry about this one, but maybe I also allow you to do part of the render in me now and pass in this additional part so that I can sort of take a little bit of the process away from you, but you still do the rest of it and I don't have to worry about it. Okay, and now here's the final example we're going to look at. Which is kind of the retain mode problem, the typical retained mode API problem that we get into when you don't provide some of the ability to do things immediately. So I've used the physics engine here because this is they're kind of the thing that's most typically known for being very retained mode heavy. Snippet A is kind of what you would typically see in a physics API. It's like I'm going to create this rocket and this pole that's stuck in the ground, and I'm going to create a joint between them. Anyone who's ever played Rocket Jockey knows where this comes from. And I'm going to kind of like constrain the rocket to the pole so that as the rocket goes, it kind of is circling around the pole. And then I call simulate, and it kind of just all magically works, and everyone's happy. My rocket's flying around. It's great. But what happens, unfortunately, in game development is you know, that's not really very representative of what happens. What typically happens is I've got something that's like some sample thing that's very fine-grained, like is the user pressing the X button? And what I have to do if this is what my API looks like is I got to go, oh, well, if they're pushing the X button, then if I'm not already having one of these hook lines in there, I've got to make one. And if I had one and they weren't pushing the button, then I've got to delete it and remember that I deleted it. And then I can simulate. So what I'm essentially doing there is I'm writing almost the like diff for every part of my game where I diff their retain mode version with what I actually know to be going on in my game, and hopefully I did the diff properly and made all the right calls to like change it up, right? That is really heinous when you end up working in an app like this. Like, I think probably most people in the audience have had to deal with this at some point if they've ever used a heavily retain mode API. What I'd much rather do is turn this ugly snippet that I don't like into this snippet. I mean, this is all I was trying to do. All I'm trying to do is say, hey, you know what? Do a joint between the rocket and the pole when the X button's down. Like, that's what I was trying to do. So instead of writing this, I want to be able to write this. And that's the real difference between immediate mode and retain mode. It's like, immediate mode allows you to procedurally do something. So you've got code. Code is very powerful. You're making decisions in that code, and you want to be able to just dish the output of that code directly to the API and have it use it. You don't want to have to go through a data intermediary, which is the retained part of it, which you constantly have to worry about how to differentially update. And the thing that I'd like to remind everyone here, because, hey, you know, I can only show so much on a slide, is that having a do joint call like this immediate mode is much more powerful than if I, say, had just a Boolean that I could turn on and off in a retained mode joint. And the reason for that is, what if I have no idea what pole the guy is going to catch this time? Well, like, I don't want to have to do stuff like create speculative joints between all the rockets and all the poles and then just turn the Boolean on and off so I can have the nice immediate mode feel, right? I don't want to do any of that stuff. So the idea behind immediate mode is I've gone through the code, I've figured out exactly what I want to do, I just want to call the API with it right there, and I don't want to have to worry about having set up a retained mode structure previously, which will allow me to have that code look the way I want, which is what Booleans in a retained mode thing would do for you. So that's not a substitute. So finally, you know, now I've hopefully given you an idea of how those five characteristics kind of work when you look at the code. What ends up happening, I think, with most APIs, not that there's that many that have tried kind of to do all this stuff, but when you look at them, I've talked to some people who've actually done a bunch of this stuff, and they kind of seem to concur with me. So when you kind of follow these, either by intuition or because you've sat down and actually looked at what all they all are, the APIs that work the best for reuse across multiple projects that are different, very different from each other, you know, wide reuse kinds of situations, that people have a pleasant time with, is that when you optimize these five characteristics, you get an API which kind of has gradual tiers to it, right? There's like lots of different kind of ways that I can access this API, and I can gradually move between them as I need to. They're highly decoupled, so I may even have multiple tiers of stuff that don't even necessarily have to like kind of couple to each other. They're very separated. If I decide to start getting more, you know, finer grained in one area, then I don't have to drag down everything there. They're all kind of like staying at the level that I roughly want. They have no retain mode stuff at their bottom. So in other words, at the very, very finest level that I can call this API, it is not retaining data, at least not that I know about. If it is, it's behind the scenes. It's caching. It's stuff they're doing for performance. But I am not responsible for doing that caching for them. And as you kind of go up through the tiers, maybe there is some retain mode. You know, sometimes I do want to just say create rigid body, create rigid body, create joint. There's nothing wrong with that. But by the time I get down to the part where I'm asking the API I want control here, I don't expect to have that be happening. And then finally, I'd say that you pretty much never want to be in the situation of having the API dictate the flow control to you, because most of the time there's really just no reason for that. So that's kind of what I see as like the way APIs look when you've really kind of got this stuff dialed. And granted, like, you know, like I was saying with Granny 1 and Granny 2, I think we got a lot of the stuff in Granny 2, but, you know, I look back at it now, obviously, and there's tons of stuff I would do differently. So it's not like I'm claiming that, you know, I've ever made an API which does all these things perfectly, but it definitely, as you kind of feel like you're making APIs better, I feel like they go towards this. And I think over the next few years, we'll start seeing APIs that kind of, if they can do this, will kind of get more towards that kind of perfect point where all these things are working together properly. So, you know, some of you may not have wanted to spend a full 50 minutes talking about this stuff. So, you know, right now I've summarized it all into just like a minute's worth, so you can get it all right now. If you are designing an API or if you're about to evaluate an API, these couple slides should give you everything that you need to know to cheat on the exam. The first and second things that you need to know, and this is kind of obvious, but I just wanted to state it because most of this lecture is about the more detailed stuff, is just that always write the usage code first. You know, I mean, when you sit down to design an API, always write all of the like examples of using it that you can think of. Write those first. Don't start by like opening up an H file and start writing a class declaration or something like that. Start by writing user code. And furthermore, if you've got a game sitting around, which a lot of you do, like pretend you're integrating it. Like pretend you have the magical API that does everything you want. Go into that game and integrate it through and look at what you came up with. That's the first pass API. That's the best first pass API you're going to get. Because all of your intuition is enabled there naturally, and you've got all of the constraints of that game already playing into it. So you've got a really good first example there. And furthermore, if you're evaluating one, you may think that the best thing to do is go read the documentation of the tools that you're potentially evaluating for licensing. Don't do that yet. Pretend you have the perfect one you want. Pretend to integrate it into the game you've got for a day or two. Look at what you came up with. And now when you evaluate those components from the different vendors, go, how close does this match what I'm going to do? Like, don't think in their terms first. Think in your terms first. And then as you evaluate your APIs, go like, which one of these things, links up with me? So anyway, most of the lecture was not on that, but I figured it was very important to mention because a lot of people won't do that. So now we get to the stuff that hopefully this lecture has argued is the right thing to do. The first thing is that any kind of retain mode construct that this API puts forth, I should be able to do the exact same thing in immediate mode by just calling a function with the things that the retain mode structure had in it, right? And that was the thing about the update node, render node thing. I should always be able to kind of have the non-node version of those so I can just call them immediately. And what that does is that allows you to transition from the retained mode to a more finer controlled immediate mode when you need to. If you don't have those, then when you need to transition, you're going to have to go, oh my god, like what was that node thing doing? I don't even know. I got to go learn about that, whatever. Second thing, anytime there's callbacks or inheritance, there should be an equivalent way to just make an API call that doesn't have to use either of those things. If you ever see something that requires inheritance or requires you to use callbacks, then that is giving up both flow control and it is coupling you. So you should never see that. If you see something like that, that's a red flag. Third thing, no API should ever require you to use a specific data type of its own if you know full well that your game and probably every other game in the universe has their own version of that data type. Like, the last thing you need is for you to go license three components from three different vendors. They all use different vector types, and you've got to use all three different vector types in various places of your app because that's what they expect. Like, that's the last thing you want to have happen. Number four, any API function that you would not consider atomic for purposes of writing your game, if you think there's any way that you might not consider that thing atomic at any time during integration, then it should be able to be replaced by between, like, say, 2 and 4 different APIs that replace it that are more granular, right? And that doesn't count maybe accessor functions, but just, the actual physical operational calls. Because if you look at something and you go, you know what? That thing looks kind of a little high level to me, and I don't see any way to break it down further, then that's a really good example of where, some point deep in the ship process, you're going to have to hope you can get one of their API developers on the phone to kind of put in some backdoor access for you or something like that, and that's really bad. And the final four things. Any data which doesn't have a reason for being opaque should be transparent. If you just have data structs that the API is using for things, those things should not be opaque, right? You always have the choice as a developer of not touching the data structures of the API. So if you're concerned about making, touching a kind of internal structure or something like that and having that break when the API gets revved, you can always decide not to do it, right? There's nothing forcing you to go look at, some of the structures that the API defines. But when it comes down to ship time, you may find that you want that access to do some things in certain places in your app. And if they aren't exposed to you, then you've kind of got this problem where you'd better hope the API has actual calls that do the sorts of stuff you need directly, or you're going to be in big trouble. So the idea is you should look through it, and while you shouldn't expect to use all of those things, you should try to make sure that they're there for when you do need them. Chris?
What is a reason to be opaque?
What is a reason to be opaque?
Yeah.
The reason that you usually make an API opaque is if you know full well that you're going to change it very soon, right? Like, as an API designer, if I'm like, okay, we put in this thing, and it's somewhat high level, and I know that we're going to modify it, like, every month or something like this. Because, you know, I mean, at RAD, for example, we rev our APIs continuously. So we may not, we may decide that, like, this particular thing can't really be made transparent yet unless they want to link with the source code, because we know that we're going to be changing the way it works underneath, and we don't want to, like, break people's compiles every month. You know what I mean? So there is a little bit of control there. As an API designer, you may go, this thing really should be opaque because I know for a fact that I'm about to cause some problems if I make it that way. But in general, you should try to make everything transparent. I mean, I certainly tried to do that with Granny 2, and the places where I didn't make things transparent, I wish I could go back and kind of have done. So I don't know. It's like it's always a judgment call, but unless you feel like they really had a reason for it. I don't know if that answers the question, but... There aren't any. If the question is, are there specific like rules about when to make something opaque? I don't think so. Like, the rule is make everything transparent that you can. I guess is what I'd say.
I design a lot of opaque APIs, and the reasons I do it, I have a philosophy of minimizing the dependencies, so I don't want anybody to know about my internal implementation. Feel that when they use my API, they don't know, and they don't care, and shouldn't care. And I also do it for a lot of reasons that were brought up yesterday, which is for protection.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way of saying it, right? It's like, there are certain times when you kind of feel like this thing really does need to be opaque. Like, I have a legitimate reason for making this thing opaque. And, you know, it may be personal preference as to how often that comes up. The idea that I'm just trying to get home here is that the conventional wisdom is always make everything opaque. And what I'm trying to say is that you really want things to be transparent. So when you make them opaque, have a really good reason for making it opaque, is I guess what I'm saying. So I'm not necessarily trying to dictate, like, make everything transparent or anything like that, but I'm just trying to say, you know what, transparency has a lot of really big benefits. So when you take it away, make sure you know why you took it away. And the example for transparency, at least, you know, with Granny is that, like, a lot of users want control over how the data is moved throughout memory, and they want to be able to create certain versions of it with their own ways of interleaving things or that kind of stuff. Transparency allows them to do all that stuff. So that was a really big benefit when you kind of go, okay, we know that this part of the API is pretty locked down, we've got it pretty solid, now's a good time to make that transparent because it gives people a lot of things to do. But if you're kind of still churning on it a little bit, maybe now's not such a good time to make that transparent. But keep thinking in your head, when I get this stuff locked down, maybe I will make it transparent that time, because now I know that's okay to kind of have that out there. You know, it's a trade-off. Chris?
It seems like what you're saying, Casey, and let me know if I'm interpreting this correctly, is that you're saying granularity and transparency should be linked. If you have exposed a level of granularity of operation on something, you should also be exposing the transparency of the user to understand it at that granular level. And I think what John is saying is that when you were designing a system where there are some levels of granularity you're not ready to or you have no intention of exposing, that's a good reason for keeping it opaque. But what you're saying is that the lowest level at which you make something granular, it should be transparent enough that it's understandable and that those interfaces are not just the code interfaces about flow control, but also the data interfaces that are kind of, there's an implicit granularity there.
Yeah, that's an excellent way to put it. I mean, one of the things is you can, it is kind of like, I guess they talked a little bit about trusted, you know, development kind of yesterday. And one of the things is, at least at RAD, a lot of our customers are excellent programmers, you know, and I trust them to know that when they're going down into some of these like more low-level ways of using the thing, that they know what they're doing, right? They know that that has certain implications, that if I rev things, it's going to maybe break something, et cetera, et cetera. But the point is, like, hey, when you kind of have that, when the API presents itself that way, it gives the user the option of calling it at a higher level. So if what they want is insulation from your changes, they can still get that. But when they don't want that, they can get down lower, you know? Jay?
So just as an experiment, what's the difference between that and just doing the source code? Because one of the problems with making really granular, really transparent stuff is that it also is in the same API. It's really hard to get your head wrapped around the concepts that the API contains. Whereas your low granularity, not being a very opaque API, it's really easy to absorb. So it almost seems like you want to put you don't want to put all of that in front of the user right away. And one easy way to manage that is to extract everything and give everybody source code. So if they need to go, high granularity, they just go into the source code for the parts they want to get into. Because you're going to have this couple of your source code if you have this really granular API.
Yeah. Well, actually, I mean, I guess, Jay, I don't really think they're that different. I guess kind of, if you look at the way I was talking about granularity, the idea is almost that. It's like at the highest level, at the coarsest level of granularity, you kind of have this abstract API that's very insulated. The lowest level of the API should essentially be the source code, right? I don't necessarily want people linking directly with the source code because that can be more complicated for them, so I just want to provide them a DLL, kind of thing. So it's not like they're literally compiling the source code into the game, but it's very close to that. And the idea is just don't have those be the only two things you provide. Because what I don't want to have happen is them have to go from using the super coarse-grained API all the way to using the source code, just wham. What I want to be able to do is kind of have them kind of drip down, right? I want them to be able to go, okay, we need more here, more here, and maybe we're all the way down to the source code on this part, but then I'm not really using anything even close to that level in other parts and so on. So, I mean, kind of the idea is to provide a gradient between a opaque, well-insulated API at the top and we're directly controlling what happens at the bottom, which is very close to source code. So I don't really think there's really that much difference between those two things. Yes.
You're just like giving them sort of code. But I just to throw out personal experience with Mavic on Apple, we basically had that set, right? You had the source code and you had a few levels of granularity, but not super deep. And I don't know exactly what you're advocating on that because we're kind of talking about traction. I didn't change their code very much, right? But when I need to do the highly granular thing and we're going to ship, I need this feature and, it's really granular change, I go in and put it in the source code and I can still merge updates from those guys or whatever. It wasn't like, I'm going to go in and rewrite all the source code. It's like, if somebody does that, then you kind of deserve the headaches afterwards, right? Why did you license it if you're going to get in and totally change it, right? But so the granular, the highly granular stuff seems tended to be really searchable, I guess is what I'm saying, and not a problem from that. But they do have multiple levels of granularity, like you're saying.
Okay. I unfortunately, one of the things with Havoc is you can't look at their API if you're not licensed. So I don't really know, I can't comment too much on that one particular.
Well, we did it years and years ago, and we had an NDA with them, their API before we licensed it.
Oh, gotcha.
I don't know if that's the goal. I have no idea what we're doing
now. Are we officially in Q&A, or do you have more slides?
No, actually, that was the last slide.
Okay. One more slide?
Yeah. I think everyone probably could have read it by now. Basically, all I was going to say is, You should never have to use their resource management, which means like memory management, file management, string management, and so on. Excuse me. And you should never have to use their file format, and you should always be able to get full source code to the runtime. So those are pretty simple.
Yeah, one thing I want to throw in,
Brian,
as my own comment.
Oh, can Brian go first? He's been...
Okay, Brian. Okay. Well, this is short, which is just that we ended up talking about granularity right there, and like having the source code solves granularity, but some of the other properties can get in the way of that. Like if there's a lot of coupling, right, which the designer of the API felt like all that coupling was okay because they wrote all these abstractions and you shouldn't have to think about it. Like then when you go down into the update routine and you copy the source code and you start messing with it or whatever, that coupling is going to kind of hose you, right? Because there's all these implicit things that you don't necessarily know about. So I think that when you end up designing an API to have the gradient like this, to have the granularity gradient, you end up trying to resolve the coupling and things like that naturally, and you make it easier for a user, I think.
Well, but the other thing, I guess, as a kind of a counter data point, there's very few people I know who are able to do that, like what you said there, just like, oh, you know, I was using Havoc and like I need to make some changes. I went in the source code, did it, it was no big deal. Like, that doesn't tend to be the typical thing that I hear. And, you know, a lot of times it's more like, oh, we had all these things and we couldn't do whatever. And so, I don't know, like, you may have just been particularly good at doing that. I don't know that that's necessarily typical. Especially, like, I know at RAD, most people, when we license them, they don't really want to ever see the source code. You know, that's not something they want to do. Like, they want to know that it's available should they need it, but they'd much prefer to always stay in the API, in the documented API, as much as possible. So I didn't really find that most people were like, oh, yeah, don't worry about it. We'll just go change it in the source. You know, some people are that way, but a lot of people, that's not necessarily the case. So I don't know about that part, too, which is slightly different. Yeah. Well, the way we kind of did it, I'm notoriously like not the best documentation writer, so I probably should not be giving any advice on that subject. But like the way that we tried to do it was like we'd have samples and tutorial things in the manual that would be like, here's how you do this thing, and then we'd have like, okay, so you want some control over process blah. Now here's all of that in detail. So the user just like implements at high level for a while, and then they go, you know what, I really need to be able to like use my own file format. So they go read the doc on using your own file format, and it talks about like, okay, here's how you do the internal blah, here's how you do, you know, this, that, and the other thing. So typically, I'd say the best strategy for that is to kind of identify lots of the different ways in which people will need to drill down and write special purpose docs for each one of those particular things, you know? That's the way like you do it from a licensable standpoint. If you're just doing it reuse and you know internally, then maybe the right thing to do is the first couple times that happens, write it yourself, and put up the code that you wrote as documentation that's commented. Like, okay, you know what, someone needed to do this, so I did it for them, and here's the thing. Now anyone else can reference that if they want to do that same kind of granular part or whatever.
Reverse the question, Jay. What do you think the best way to
code that? Well, source code, it sounds like. You could label them. I mean, as long as people tend to look at the APIs through the docs, you know, like if you think about how you tend to look at like Microsoft's APIs, you tend to look at the sample code and the index in MSDN. You know, that's a lot of people's like mental window into those things. So I think like as long as you properly have those things categorized in there, that goes a long way. You know what I mean? Because if they never even click on that little plus in front of the like low-level API sections, they're never going to see those, you know?
Except for, I don't know. One place where it does matter is the data transparency you want to see. Like, if you've got a struct with, you know, granular or something like that, like, and you've got a bunch of internal shit that you want to be transparent about, if you're cool and there's some effect of the matrix anyway, like, just the way C is set up, you've got to declare all that right there from C at the top of the header.
For smaller APIs, the header file, I mean, maybe they're routinely looking in the header file, but for larger APIs, the header files tend, like, you know, you don't often look for the API in Windows.h or, you know, wherever it is, because there's, like, so many, like, crazy, like, pragmas and things, and it's like, people normally look at the online help, or they look at the sample code, so typically they're not going to know all of those structures just because they are routinely, like, grazing through this 160K you know, H file or something that's the whole API or whatever, you know, that kind of.
We have a question on the left here.
Yeah, actually, you guys have kind of managed to cover what I was going to say. I was going to relate an anecdote. When Zach was using Granny for some Shadow Garden stuff, his immediate reaction was like, I can't figure out what to do. There's like 80 ways to approach this thing. Like, what the hell am I supposed to use it for? And so I was just going to ask you about that, and basically you've kind of covered. Samples seem like the right way to imply usage.
Well, Zach kind of would probably say that about anything.
That's probably true. Yeah.
But, I mean, you do have... One of the problems with Granny in particular, which is kind of separate from APIs in general, is that a lot of people who are using it have never worked with character animation in general. So there's kind of like more of a problem with that in specifically, mm-hmm. which is to say that if you're doing anything other than just the basic stuff that the sample code does, you kind of end up in a situation where, like, and we kind of do an insufficient job of this, of, like, educating the user on, like, all of the things that happen in lower-level character animation, which you should do. I mean, again, like, as a lifecycle component, like, you know, hey, we should probably have docs that are, like, here is, like, all the stuff you should know about character animation, and here's, like, you know, subjects on that and that kind of mm-hmm. sort of thing, which helps. Because a lot of times it's, like, you know... The ways to do things are relatively obvious to someone who knows character animation, but they may not be for someone who doesn't. So simply having the documentation there is not necessarily sufficient. Because you could say, like, if you want to do X, then you want to use this. If you want to do Y, then you want to use this. But they may not know what those two things are, what the trade-offs are. And if you don't have sufficient documentation for that, it doesn't matter how clear you made the API. You're still kind of... lost.
I guess it's kind of like the documentation is the bridge there, because even no matter how granular you make your API, it's not like programmers can do arbitrary thing. You know, you still have something in mind for the ways that you expect it to be used and the things that you expect it to be able to do and kind of the paths that you as the API designer are in you know, explicitly supporting.
Well, or more specifically, what typically happens is, you know, everyone can use the sample code and run the basic stuff and, like, you know, they have a character animating or whatever, but then they're like, I need to do this more granular thing, right? Because they know that they need to because they have to get it working. But they don't actually know how that thing works at all. Or maybe, like, I mean, a lot of people who integrate it don't even have any idea how, like, Max works. Like, they can't even load up the animation and look at it, for example. So they don't really have any real basis to do that. And so you really want, like, as you go down to those levels of granularity, if it's something that the person is unfamiliar with, ideally you need a lot of documentation there because you really want to educate them about, like, all of these issues, like root node motion or something like this that no one probably has ever thought about if they never worked on character animation is a huge topic. You know, you could have a lecture on that. And so, you know, if you don't have that there, then presenting the user with these more granular APIs for dealing with it isn't really going to help you, right? But that said, also, obviously, like I said before, there's tons of ways that, you know, the Granny 2 API could be improved. So it's also just possible that, hey, he may have been on some part that was just like, that should be fixed. You know, I mean, I don't know because it's hard to say. If that helps.
I have some experience to address why give a highly granular API when you can just give the source code. What I find to be convenient there is it's another level of contract with a person consuming the system. If you're using the source code as opposed to the highly granular API, then you know you're traveling into things that might shift on you with the next release. Because with an updating component, you always want to be able to do performance enhancement. You want to be able to add new features. And plain and simple, the source code's going to change, whereas you're going to try to respect the highly granular API.
Hopefully
Yeah, there's a little bit of risk insulation, but again, you know, the lower you go, the more risk there is, just in general.
I'm looking for anyone besides Chris Hecker or John Ratcliffe.
I have a question. What, we've got someone behind you with their hand.
What about, yeah, there's a neither option.
I have a question, raise a hand question for the group. If you get a highly granular API, is your first response to put a wrapper around it or just start integrating it in your code base?
So actually,
you have granny structs everywhere in your code.
That's a pretty interesting point, too, which I didn't mention because I kind of didn't fit in with the lecture. One of the mantras at RAD was that the user always wraps your API, so expect it. And so one of the things we didn't do is, like, we don't ship C++ wrappers for our stuff. And the reason for that is because we go, if we shipped a C++ wrapper, people would immediately wrap the wrapper with their own C++ version because they have a way that they like that stuff to work. And there's no way that we can provide enough wrappers that will mirror all of those things. So we never did anything like that. We were just like, we provide, you know, the calls to do it at multiple levels of granularity, and you will build the wrapper that makes you most happiest. The nice part about that, and I don't know if maybe this is what you're getting at with the question, is that that kind of insulates, even if you're using a high level of granularity, that does insulate the rest of your app from changes that we make. So that component wrapper has the ability to be very powerful because it can go drill straight down to very detailed parts of the API. But then if those change, it doesn't explode through the whole application. And so typically, yeah, I mean, you always expect to be wrapped, I think, because that's not only is that the user making the component into the thing that they want it to be, but it's also part of the way that they understand the component, right? They don't really understand the component when they first get it. They don't really understand how it works with subtleties. They build the wrapper kind of as a way of understanding how to map the way that component thinks about things into the way that they think about things. And that's a valuable process, and it shouldn't really be something that you try to eliminate, I don't think.
No, I'm glad to get that confirmation. I guess the point I was getting at is that that's kind of the first step. They go in, design yet another API is their first thing.
Yeah, and I don't... Some people may look at that and go, we should try and eliminate that. I don't really think so. Like, I think that's a valuable part of the process, and it's kind of their way of defining the actual set of things they actually want specifically, which are different from what every other API may want in some subtle ways. Can we do this one first, and then we'll cue you?
Okay, I work in a studio where we have a core engineering team that actually develops a game engine that gets reused inside of like 4 or 5 production teams. And one of the ways we've actually accomplished transparency is actually through the granularity of the API rather than exposing data structures. And that actually helps us to address coupling issues where, you know, if they use some specific granularity, we can guarantee that the coherency of the data when they're using a higher granularity in some other aspects of the game engine. Now, that doesn't prevent them from actually writing their own set of utilities that wrap around the APIs inside of the game engine proper. So, I mean, that's worked pretty well for us up to now without having to expose the data structures because we're in a constant, we're constantly being demanded to add new features to the game engine which actually modifies those data structures. And we don't want them necessarily to have to revisit all the code they're writing for their game because we're changing those data structures. So by accomplishing the transparency at the granularity of the API, we've managed to actually control this very efficiently inside the organization.
Well, there's a couple things about that. The first one is that you have to kind of look sometimes at why are people drilling down to that level, right? They're not like just drilling down to that level because they like having very like explicit things down there. It's usually because they're trying to get some very specific performance gain or some very specific like memory gain or something like this. So one of the things that can be a little bit of a pitfall is to assume that because you've put an API there, that somehow you've insulated the app from having to worry about your changes. In reality, like, how much insulation is that really? Because let's say that you go and then make the kind of major change to one of those underlying structures that you may need to make. Well, does that invalidate the performance gains that they got from having that API? So even though their code still compiles, do you still achieve the thing that was trying to be achieved from the drill down? And I would say that any appreciable level of insulation there, if you're actually insulating, then I don't know that you can really guarantee that, because either you've insulated it enough that you can make that major change, in which case I don't see how those APIs could really guarantee that you're not going to affect the reason for having gotten down there in the first place, or they're direct mapping enough that I'm not sure that how major of a change you really could make down there. You know what I mean? Because when I talk about the drilling down to that level, I'm talking about stuff like we needed to like have you operate on this thing directly in AGP memory and having it be packed in this particular order because of the way that we're doing our streaming system and all that kind of stuff. I don't really know like that I could really say that APIs are a substitute there for the app literally knowing like the size of the structs and being able to place them directly at least. And sometimes having direct access. So maybe like you don't necessarily have to have direct access to the members, but at the very least, direct access to the placement and size is I think pretty crucial. For you know, and again, in house that may not be as much of a problem because a smaller number of games using it, and also you are in the position to sort of like systemically affect the way that they're using it. At a licensable vendor, you can't exactly tell, you know, 400 people that, you know, you want them to not do thing X. That doesn't go over, you know, really well. So there might be different trade-offs there as well that you can make that a larger component, a more reused component couldn't. So obviously, yeah, scale things depending on how many people are using it might be a good mantra.
Yeah, I just had a comment on the sort of adding a layer on top of reusable components. It's often not a matter of designing a new API that fits for the game, but it's a matter of retrofitting what you currently have to replace.
Yeah.
And so the more granularity you have, it's generally easier for you to do that. But it really puts a more burden on the documentation because the more ways you have to do things, the harder it is to figure out, you know, how are you really supposed to do things.
One of the things that was interesting yesterday while I was watching the other four lectures was that, like, actually during the four tech lead lectures, they kind of, like, mentioned a lot of this stuff implicitly, right? Like, I think, like, Chris Butcher mentioned, like, multiple times, like, blah, 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 except for Havoc, so we couldn't do it totally that way, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, and that was, like, a good example of, like, okay, you know, this API didn't allow us to integrate it into our system in a way that was uniform. There was, like, Andrew Wilmot was saying stuff about like, well, we couldn't do blah because of scene graph, you know, in certain places. Like, so it's like, okay, yeah, retain mode things that you had to use didn't like allow you to do what you want and so on. So like, it kind of sounded like they kind of covered a number of these sorts of things with components that are supposed to be reused. So that was kind of interesting, I thought, because it mapped like more to kind of what I was going to say than I had anticipated having them mention at any time.
Two questions for you, Casey. One is, do you think that the emphasis you're placing on transparency is perhaps a result of the fact that when you're writing Granny, a lot of what Granny does is it provides mechanisms for data storage of resources and things like that. It seems like APIs, components which are more about behavior and functionality and less about bulk data storage are likely to be less about transparency. For example, if you're writing AI and physics components, I would expect that there'd be a lot less emphasis for transparency than there is on something that's writing animation. Does that seem about right to you?
I don't have a lot of experience with AI, so I guess I couldn't say. For physics, I would say definitely no. Physics and character animation are almost the same thing to me. They both have some kind of author time component. Like with the physics system, you've got to author the collision geometries, you've got to have masses and things like that that come in. So it's very much a data storage format. Just like character animation is. And similarly, it's got kind of the same kind of integration into the app. It's the app is giving you a bunch of information about what it needs to have happen. You're giving a bunch of information back to the app about where things actually went and when they went there and what happened with, you know, such and so forth. So I'd say that, like, physics and character animation are almost the same problem in terms of integration. Physics is a little harder on the object coupling side because you've got a lot more interactions between objects that aren't really decided by the app. And character animation is a little harder on the data management side because you've got a lot more data coming into it. But on the whole, I see them as pretty similar. AI, I don't have any experience with, so I'm not sure. However, what I would say is that what seems to generally always be the case is you always need to end up doing some advanced memory or streaming kinds of operation with any API that you use. You know, physics, you mentioned in your own talk, physics had, you know, the physics API you're using had implications for, you know, how you did your level load and how that stuff kind of worked. And so I think that, like, it doesn't really matter what kind of component it is. There are always some kind of similar parts to it. And getting more control over the memory and how it interacts with level load and that kind of stuff is almost universal across components that we actually care much about. So I don't know, like, that'd be my own thing, my own take on it.
That makes a little bit of sense. I just want to say one more thing, then I'll hand it back. But I think it's true that for a physics-type API, there is definitely the component of data storage and authored data, but there's also a lot more, far more complex runtime state. And the interesting thing about the runtime state is the transparency you need over that is kind of generalized in the sense that you need to be able to provide services for allocation and destruction and things like that, but I think there's a lot less need to inspect the internals when those are particularly a lot more complex in the case of a physics API, because there is a lot more that is not about the authored format, but is really about the algorithms and the subdivision and things like that that necessarily doesn't need that higher level of exposure to most clients.
Well, two things about that. First of all, the most clients part is kind of the fuzzy area, right? Which is like if you're shipping something that's supposed to be used across a lot of games, you end up having the situation of like most clients isn't all clients. So even if you think most clients, well, you know that some people are going to have to do that, whatever it is. So there is that. But kind of more generally speaking, I think physics in particular, if we're just talking about that as a thing, I think the reason that most people don't utilize lower level access to it is because there's just a lot less understanding of it. You know, like most people know enough about meshes and things like that that they can go diving into Granny and make some changes that they want to make, and that's all good, right? I certainly don't know enough about physics to go diving into like Havoc or something and change it, but that's probably going to change, you know? Character animation, if the stuff that was in Granny was around in 1990, people would be like, I have no idea what any of this crap is and I'm not touching it. But now, like, we kind of all do. We all know how smooth skinning works and all these sorts of things. It's just taken for granted. It's like, it's just understood. So as a result, you want kind of that control because you know what to do with that. And I don't think physics will be much of an exception. Like, I think, like, we'll kind of all know the basics of it in 10 years from now, let's say. And then I think at that point, the API design problem comes exactly the same. You're going to want to go in there. You're going to want to tweak the way it computes, like, you know, the momentum of the system, because you know that you can, like, do some kind of thing where you're locking a guy onto the ground that way. And, like, I mean, it just seems to me like the level of access is not because of what it is, but because as an industry it's new to us, and that's really most of it. Do you know what I mean? But who knows, right? I mean, only time will tell with those sorts of things.
Thinking about that, there are some components that would be really truly black box where, like, we had to talk about using perhaps a neural net for that, and there you could expose all the weights of the neural net, but it's just not meaningful. It's only meaningful within the behavior, and you being able to manipulate them just doesn't have any meaning. And like you're saying with the physics, there still are some things that really are part of the system overall, and to have an interface and actually change it doesn't have any meaning except in the context of like behavior. So there probably is some component where I don't think it would hurt to have the transparency, but it's just not meaningful to the application at all.
But okay, even just to like make something up totally randomly, even in the case of something like a neural net, right? Where nobody knows what any of these weights even mean, I could easily see, like, my anticipation would be that if I went and did, like, RAD's neural net license library or something, and I didn't provide that transparency, sometime, a year after that thing was released, I would get a support call of the form, well, we have a lot of neural nets. In fact, like, we've got, like, 500 neural nets that we're using at runtime. And we need to be able to page them out based on usage. So I was wondering if we could like have some way of disconnecting some of the neural nets when they get further away from the camera so I could page out pieces of them so that they still kind of like are there roughly, and when I know that they're getting hit, I'll like page that like That's a totally made-up example, but, like, I know it would happen. Like,
and
I know that it would happen to me.
Chris was saying about there's a lot of the allocation and storage issues that
yeah.
are always an issue. But there are, like, in I haven't used Havoc a long time, but there's the magic tau values and things that are down there that
yeah.
just have no meaning to anybody but the guy who wrote the algorithm. Just exposing that may provide more confusion. And it leads to what Dave Wu was talking about, which is you end up with your code that's broken because you're using something you don't understand.
Yeah, again, I mean, it could be. You always run that risk of, like, giving people more power than they are able to use without hurting themselves. But the other problem is, like, you know, what's the alternative, right? The alternative is you take somebody who was, you know, capable enough to do the right thing with it, and you've essentially, you've screwed them because you were trying to protect somebody who didn't know what they were doing, you know? And, like, I don't know, I always liked to make the trade-offs on the side of, like, you know what? There's going to be people who know this stuff as well or better than I do, and they're only using my component because it's saving them time. I'm going to let them do everything they possibly can. And hey, you know what? If someone tries to use it who doesn't know those things, it's just more tech support calls for me, and that's okay. You know, that's what I'm there for, right? So it's all good, you know?
One quick comment generated just from the past 5 minutes of this discussion, and then a quick question. The quick comment is, docs didn't appear anywhere on your API evaluation slides, but we've all been saying, basically, as you increase the level of granularity, your doc requirements go way up to prevent a bunch of these problems. So, like, you want...
Well, there's a couple of things, right? If you notice, like, the talk was only on the API design part, and that was kind of intentional, but there's a lot of other stuff here that's, like, if you're actually, you know, talking about the literal making of these components, you've got more than just docs, right? There's things like you want lots of error checking, and you want to be... Like, some of the things that Charles was talking about, one of the things that we didn't do very well in Granny 2 is we don't ship a separate debug build, and that's something that really, like, should happen. And, you know, you want things like that. Those are definitely important, but I just didn't feel like I could cover all that extra stuff. Those things are like code, strictly code-oriented. They have nothing to do with the interface to it. But yeah, they're all very important. Like access to the person who wrote it, being able to like have documentation that's, you know, right, lots of sample code, all of these things are like also very important. So I don't mean to like exclude them. I just didn't feel like I could cover all that stuff too.
And the super quick question is, besides Granny, what's a good API in your opinion?
Well, you know, Granny's like not even like a great API or anything, right? It's like it was the best one I could do after one iteation. I don't really know because I don't have a huge experience with all of the APIs, and a lot of them I see are very bad. But like one that I think is probably pretty good, and I could be totally wrong about this, is Renderware Graphics, because like a lot of people were saying. Like that it's a very toolkit-oriented approach. It's kind of just like what I was talking about with the least complex, not all retain mode, that kind of thing. And it's gotten pretty widespread adoption and seems to be kind of usable. So I'm sure it has tons of problems, just like Granny 2 has problems. But it kind of sounds like that, you know, if I had access to their SDK and went and checked it out, I'd probably be like, okay, it looks like, you know, looks like they think a lot of the same things about this because they're, you know, they're allowing access at that low level and not trying to make some kind of big class diagrammy kind of thing. But at the same time, I don't know. One of the things about component reuse in the game industry is there are very few components that are widely used. Even something that's fairly widely received, like Havoc, there's very few people who actually license it. It's not really in the like, you know, 200-300 people range. It's way less than that. So, you know, components of the scale of Granny in terms of how many people are using it, there's like very few, and a lot of them were also RAD APIs, and they weren't necessarily APIs that were doing something that complicated. Like Bing, for example, all it does is play a movie. So you know, you don't end up with a lot of these issues. If that's the only thing that you're trying to do, you can make a pretty good granular, you know, API with enough access in, you know, 30 function calls. So I don't know. It's kind of hard to say. And as we get more components, maybe we'll see more of that. But a lot of game components just fail immediately, so there's not that many.
All right, we're going to do a 10-minute break. Thanks, Stacey.